Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming out on this threatening day to hear Prue Goud, who makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She's been here on quite a few occasions before, but I think for the first time in her capacity as a minister, although not for the first time since she's been in the New South Wales Parliament. She's well known to all of you. I'll introduce her very briefly. She had a career in journalism at the ABC. She's had a career in academic life. She's been executive director of the Office of the Status of Women. She's worked for the Australian Property Institute, the Federal Sex Discrimination Commissioner, and among many other things. But since 2007, the member for Goulburn, and since the election of the O'Farrell government, a minister in the O'Farrell government. And tonight, the minister's going to speak to us on New South Wales Family and Community Services, from managing disadvantage to breaking it. Prue Goud, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Gerard, and it's very nice to see so many people here tonight. Well, new governments always have a choice. They can choose business as usual, or they can choose change. And that choice was clear for the Liberal Nationals when we were elected in New South Wales on the 26th of March. But when it came to the way our state cared for its most vulnerable and disadvantaged, there in fact was no choice. We simply had to change. In child protection especially, the outcomes were disappointing, some would say shocking. Billions of dollars in additional spending, regular and growing budget overruns, a number of major inquiries recommending various significant reforms, and still no improvement in the lives of the children. In fact, as many have observed, the outcomes were getting worse. New South Wales suffered the shame of removing the greatest number of children in Australia, and at more than 1 in 100, the highest rate of removal in Australia. Aboriginal children were and still are being removed at a rate 8 times higher than that. Children known to the department continued to die in terrible circumstances at the hands of parents or stepparents. Children removed often went on to repeat the cycle of abuse and neglect as parents themselves. The intergenerational cycle of disadvantage and poverty was not only continuing unbroken, it was spiralling out. For all the money, for all the millions of words over the past 16 years, dysfunction in all its ugliness has remained. There'd been little change in the way governments did its work with our most disadvantaged children and young people. New South Wales, of course, has not been alone in this. Increasingly, when confronted with the complexity of dysfunction and deprivation, and its resistance to government intervention, no matter how well-intentioned, governments have become wary and weary of change, no longer believing it will or can be for the better. Welfare has increasingly assumed an air of sad resignation, an acceptance that we can do no better. That is not to say that there aren't government and other organisations and individuals within them who are determined to move people from despair to hope, from dependence to independence, but they're overwhelmed by a system that has increasingly conspired against them. In New South Wales, in short, the former government stopped fighting the damage to families and settled for managing it. Labor managed it politically by removing children as a first response and by shrouding their work in increasing secrecy and complexity. They managed it in policy terms by doing more of what they'd done before. And despite the potential of hard-working staff in both government and non-government organisations, Labor did not veer from the path it was on. So that is, in fact, the choice we face today. Do we continue to manage disadvantage, ladies and gentlemen, or do we break it? Shall we continue with the business as usual, the poor will always be with us approach, or do we launch ourselves into the battle, determined to break that cycle by shifting the way we work? We need to do so much better for troubled families in New South Wales, and that means understanding why all the money and all the words have made so little difference. First of all, I think there are clearly a number of sociological factors at work beyond the control of state governments alone. Australia-wide, birth rates in families with low income, low education and low employment are now significantly higher than the birth rates of high income, highly educated families. The lowest 20% of households by income have an average birth rate of 2.4, whereas the highest 20% of households by income have an average of 1.4 children born. Similar birth rate differentials are also provided by the Hilda survey conducted by the Melbourne Institute of Applied Economic and Social Research. And that means the absolute number of disadvantaged people is growing faster than the overall population. And inevitably, this puts pressure on educational and public health authorities and resources, as well as welfare. But it cannot be changed by state governments acting alone. Access to illegal drugs and alcohol is also greater than ever before, which not only affects an individual's capacity to function, but in particular to parent. What is more, fetal alcohol and drug-related disorders are now recognised to be the largest combined source of intellectual disability in the Western world, all self-imposed. Modern drug and alcohol abuse contributes not only to disadvantage over the life cycle of the people afflicted, but very often also that of their children. The extent to which state and federal governments work together on these issues is critical in breaking the cycle, but it is not the end of the story. We know the risk factors for social and family dysfunction. There is no rocket science left to be learnt. Domestic violence, drug and alcohol abuse, and mental illness or cognitive disability overwhelmingly occur in families where children die either accidentally or by intent. We know there are a range of secondary factors, such as the age of parents, the numbers of people in the household, social isolation, and the incidence of disability in a child, which further add to the risk of a child being harmed. In other words, some contributors to child abuse and neglect and intergenerational disadvantage are clearly within the capacity of state governments to affect, and it is these which principally concern me tonight. While obviously education and health programs are very important to addressing disadvantage, as Minister, my focus is the work of the Department of Family and Community Services. The Department of Family and Community Services, or FACS, is one of the nine clusters in the new New South Wales government. It includes the Division of Community Services, Housing New South Wales and the Aboriginal Housing Office, and Ageing, Disability and Home Care, ably led by my colleague Andrew Constance, the Minister for Ageing and the Minister for Disability Services. These important services are under one roof to encourage coordination and integration of improved services. Housing, for example, is a central player in the cycle of intergenerational disadvantage and poverty. Safe and affordable homes are central to safe and secure families and children. When it comes to government services, the easy refrain is the one which calls for more money. But improving services is not about the money. I'd like to say that again. It's not about the money. Spending additional billions has not made community services in New South Wales more effective, as the New South Wales Ombudsman has confirmed in reports about community services and Aboriginal disadvantage over the last few months. Our foster carers are paid more than foster carers in other states. Our caseworkers are tertiary educated and well trained, and people adopting children in New South Wales have been as generously supported as foster carers. There is an abundance of research and support programs available in this state. It's just that the system itself is not working nearly well enough. In some cases, money has actually got in the way. I was reminded even today, as I listened to a valued and professional executive in community services, that finding places to spend the additional millions in years past led to unnecessary spending. Labor's decisions without real reform will continue to divert resources from vulnerable children and young people. Other reasons would be better known to you. In New South Wales, government's famously known for its silo mentality, that is, departments not working together but acting independently. This means any number of agencies may be providing services to a family with a drug and alcohol history, a mental health problem, social isolation, unemployment, unstable housing, poor school attendance for children, and a pattern of domestic violence. All in the name of keeping the children safe from harm. But they have not worked together to ensure that that assistance is coordinated. It's meant a great deal of money and effort has been wasted. Money and effort. And frustration for hard-working staff that could have produced not only better results, but for more families and children. We knew all of that in opposition and unsurprisingly committed to breaking down those silos and forcing departments to work better together. It's a big job. It's equivalent to several Queen Marys being turned around in Sydney Harbour, but we need to pursue it relentlessly and systematically. There's also the role of the non-government sector. Traditionally in New South Wales, the vast majority of children in foster care have been in government foster care. Programs designed to help families at high risk have also been government run. Small, nimble and privately run organisations, or even large private welfare organisations that have a capacity to think laterally, react quickly and adapt to change circumstances are what has been needed. And that is what the public sector cannot and will not have it. For this reason, most other Australian child protection jurisdictions rely on the not-for-profit sector to provide the bulk of foster care, for example. In New South Wales, by contrast, the state provides 80% of general foster care. We are determined to change that in order to unleash that creativity and responsiveness for our children. There would be plenty of work left for government to do. It will certainly not save the state money, but it will mean better lives for our children and young people. Reform must mean that the billions of dollars we spend are spent better and deliver better lives. It will also allow our great staff in community services to better focus on government priorities, our statutory responsibilities. By utilising the entire sector's capabilities, we can ensure that more government and non-government caseworkers can see more children more often. The transfer of out-of-home care, otherwise known as foster care, to the non-government sector is about to begin, and success can only come from an enormous amount of effort and, I believe, a determination on all sides to do this in real partnership with one another. Even so, many non-government organisations providing a myriad of services ranging from drug and alcohol programs to family support already complain about red tape and needless accountability mechanisms which often get in the way of their actually caring for children and their families. Currently, 40% of the department's budget is spent with non-government and other third-party providers. If we are to improve our services and their effectiveness, we need to replace red tape with a working relationship that is built on trust, so that responsibility for service provision and accountability rests clearly with the funded service providers, and that includes government as well as non-government. It would be disingenuous to say that transferring to the NGOs and better service integration across government are the only reforms needed. The truth is, there's much about the way the department itself has worked, both as an investigator and as a service provider, that has contributed to the stumbling system we now have. In my view, it is important that there be a better understanding of the critical role that poor delivery can play in derailing perfectly acceptable or even laudable public policy and outstanding staff. I might also add that in observing these administrative shortcomings over the past few months, I came to understand in a sense I'd never expected the texture of the failure of the former Labor government, and that it was not confined to its failure just to manage the facts budget. Labor's failure to take responsibility for a system that they had so stuffed with red tape and accountability it could no longer function effectively as a child protection system of any distinction, their failure to question, their failure to think differently or to challenge their departments to do so, stands in my mind, in fact, as the bigger failure. Labour's mantra of we're spending the money so it must be better was entirely an abrogation of leadership. Labour failed to invest in community services organisational infrastructure. It was not just physical infrastructure, like public transport and hospitals. Their legacy was also to fail to invest in our agencies to work better and smarter. It is as important to reform public administration in this state as it is to change policy, although the two are, of course, interconnected. You cannot have good policy that responds to the circumstances confronting us without a culture of continuous improvement. And you can't have that if you don't have an effective and driven department, driven and passionate about what it does with the right systems. So let's start with the goals. The Liberal and National Government's State Plan, New South Wales 2021, has goals. Now, they're supposed to keep governments honest, especially when they are public. Labor's State Plan talked a lot about disadvantage and programs, but with very few commitments in the plan to improved results. Our State Plan goals for children are very explicit. They actually aim, they actually involve numbers, and they have a number of aims. They aim for an increased proportion of New South Wales children who are developmentally on track in Australian Early Development Index domains, being physical health, social competence, emotional maturity, language and cognitive skills, school-based, and communication and general knowledge. A reduced rate of children and young people reported at risk of significant harm, reducing that rate by 1.5% per year, and a reduced rate of children and young people in statutory out-of-home care by 1.5% per year also. Each of these is to be benchmarked at the time of our election, and they are very explicit and specific goals. They are a strong determination and demonstration of the higher accountability and transparency we're committed to reverse and repair Labor's cycle of spin and secrecy. The people of New South Wales need their governments to face scrutiny, independent scrutiny and transparency. Nothing drives reform like the discomfort of accountability. And that is why we are reforming the Child Death Review Team to ensure that it is more accountable and independent than before. We forced a reluctant Labor government to it in opposition, but we did at the time promise to fix what we thought was a half-hearted and some would say a vindictive transfer. Now we are finishing the job with amendments now at the before the Legislative Council. There will also be more general scrutiny of child deaths and the role of agencies like Family and Community Services in those deaths. The Child Death Annual Report is an important new initiative, another election commitment I will fulfil when our first report is tabled in December this year. This report, I believe, will replace the secrecy of the past with a new transparency about the most serious end of child protection work. We will report the number of children known to facts who have died, the responses they receive from community services, the lessons we have learnt from reviewing their deaths, and the initiatives we're putting into place to improve both caseworker practice and the systems which support best practice. We will also report what we've learned from the review of near misses, cases where children were seriously injured or harmed but did not die. Public reporting on community services' response to risk of significant harm reports is another example of government putting this commitment into action. We will report on the proportion of reports that children are at risk of significant harm which are closed without assessment, the proportion we assess as safe to be with their parents, and the proportion who get an early intervention, child protection or out-of-home care response. Dangerous indeed for a government. Supporting our first Child Death Annual Report will be a seminar on December the 14th to discuss with our partners how we can ensure that community services becomes that learning organisation. We must use every child tragedy to improve the way we work to protect vulnerable children, young people and families. We must do better. All of us, re-steel our determination and implement improvements in how we work. An early example of this is the work we are doing now to improve how we assess carers and their partners as suitable for foster care. Of course, a department that is open and transparent about what is done well and badly is still lost if it is incapable of responding to its mistakes or change circumstances. Unlike widget making, we are not working here with many practical facts or immutable truths. Families and communities are constantly evolving. Mores change, expectations change, technologies change, and their problems change. There will never be, at any one point in time, the perfect child protection system, because the factors that affect it are so dynamic. What we need is to be responsive to change, responsive to our own mistakes, determined always to do better, and understanding that what worked once will not necessarily work now. That means, of course, we will be looking and learning from other states and internationally wherever possible. But we also need to be guided by the one immutable truth, the one immutable truth that the child protection system is based upon, and that is we need to keep seeing children. We need decision-making tools and information systems, sure. These are far from perfect now and will only ever be a part of identifying families at risk and keeping children and young people from harm. But we need to see those children and work with those children. We need that finely trained intelligence and judgment brought to bear on every child. And that requires our caseworkers to actually see children and their families. If we are to do better, we need more caseworkers seeing more children more often. It remains true that a disconcertingly high number of cases are closed because our caseworkers do not have time to see children. This is borne out by the Ombudsman's most recent report about child protection, which found that despite the extra money and the change reporting thresholds for children at risk, we were actually seeing fewer children. He found 25% of cases are closed now without any assessment due to workload constraints. And that is precisely not what the reforms were meant to do. There are many explanations for this, of course. I've so far met with staff at community services centres around the state. It's a very dangerous place to drive reform from a desk in the city, I've discovered. And the explanations are always the same, that our workers spend enormous amounts of time photocopying, preparing for court, documenting contacts on a data management system that's cumbersome and slow. External business consultants, commissioned often by the previous government, confirm that. So we need to change all that. And I've asked the department to trial minimum monthly visits, each caseworker seeing all their children in out-of-home care at least once a month. We will then be able to work out what isn't done and what should actually be left undone, because the children have to come first. Caseworkers can put them first. We will be looking at other ways to help caseworkers do their best. Although the work of community services is very concerned with children in terrible circumstances, at high risk of harm or neglect, in fact, most of the focus of social policy needs to be earlier, before small problems become crises, and indeed in preventing problems at all. It is much more difficult to know what prevents child abuse or neglect, or what works best to contain it, than it is to predict demand for public transport, water, or electricity. For this reason, governments have been increasingly reluctant to invest in prevention or early intervention, despite its obvious importance. Investment has been replaced by lip service. Arguably, good public education and public health services are means of preventing abuse and neglect, but there is clearly a need for more targeted policies for disadvantaged families who are less, not more likely, to take advantage of free educational and health services than other families. School absenteeism, dropout rates and suspensions are more common in low socioeconomic areas than elsewhere, for example. Girls in low-income households are much more likely to have children earlier than others, despite the widespread availability of contraception and sex education. While the New South Wales government will continue to invest in early intervention, we are looking to others to help us grow the pot. So we've developed social benefit bonds, that's underway, where investors are encouraged to buy bonds in a welfare venture aimed at doing good. The investors will be repaid their money with interest if the venture can demonstrate that it prevented harm. Harm which has a significant and measurable cost to taxpayers through government.
The Attorney General, who has a deep interest in juvenile justice, has selected reoffending by minors as the preventable harm. I have selected the removal of children into state care. This is a very new approach and has only ever been trialled in the United Kingdom, so a great deal of work is being done to scope a bond and the benefit of preventing a child entering out of home care. Nevertheless, I'm confident not only that there will be programs designed to make exactly this difference, but that social benefit bonds, properly nurtured, can play an important part in broadening community involvement and resources applied to lifting children and families from lives of despair. Making early intervention work also relies heavily on everyone working together, pulling the levers. By everyone, I mean all of us, not just in government departments. For example, in the case of teen pregnancies in disadvantaged communities, it's clearly not just about access to sex education. It's about giving young people, and young women especially, other aspirations and ambitions apart from teen motherhood. They need more, not fewer, options, and education and training alternatives need to be provided. As Minister for Young Women, I want young women who do not go to university to enjoy an equally wide range of choices and opportunities. Disadvantage is the key to the vulnerability of many women and therefore of their children. Ultimately, through financial independence and freedom, we can reduce the distressing rates, for example, of domestic violence. Making the trades traditional for women is another key focus to improve women's employment opportunities and is linked to greater aspirations and freedom. We need to ensure that at-risk families have housing that avoids the overcrowding often, although not always, associated with child sex abuse. We need to ensure housing tenants with mental illness or addictions are protected from homelessness by the way Centrelink benefits are structured and delivered. We need to tackle the issue of unemployment among people with disabilities, which is why my colleague Andrew Constance, the Minister for Ageing and Disability Services, recently announced a payroll tax rebate to support employment amongst our fellow citizens. Of course, the best way of ensuring at-risk families are well managed and assisted with conquering their difficulties is to act locally, to have local organisations provide services and skills instead of relying on a head office machine to plan it and execute it from afar. And that's why we have embarked on ensuring that whether it's a local housing office, community services centre, or age, disabilities and home care office, they are all working together in the same regions with the same local services and they all know the same families. You might think that's obvious, that government departments should all have the same administrative regions, but it's never been done before in New South Wales, and I'm told that it would be the biggest public sector reform in decades if we actually pull it off. Aged, disability and home care and housing are leading this work. I look forward to working with other colleagues to integrate and coordinate government services, not least of all for Aboriginal citizens, as FACTS becomes better integrated and its systems are reformed to improve services. Make no mistake, the outcomes for children in the long-term care of the state are often very poor. It is counterintuitive, but it's a fact. While removal keeps them from death or from violence, it frequently results in youth homelessness, teenage pregnancy, unemployment, poor educational outcomes and living skills, and they are overrepresented, vastly overrepresented, in the juvenile justice system. For young people leaving care at 18, and too often they are on the streets well before that, there is a lack of permanent family in their lives, which is deeply troubling. Again, what happened to young people when they've left care just didn't seem to be part of government thinking, despite its obvious social costs and, of course, personal costs. So we certainly need to improve the way we prepare disadvantaged adolescents for adulthood, but we also need to do better at offering those real families with real connections, real homes, with ties that bind and endure throughout their lives. And that's why we are keen to promote adoption for foster children. Extraordinarily, despite the cost of international adoption and the lack of financial support for people who adopt internationally, in New South Wales in 2009-10, there were 78 inter-country adoptions and only 48 domestic adoptions of children in foster care. In fact, overseas adoptions have been from twice to 10 times the number of adoptions in out-of-home care over the last decade, despite the fact that children adopted from out-of-home care get provided greater financial support by the state than overseas adoptions. And that support begins at $18,500 a year. The 45 out-of-home care adoptions in 2010-11 compares to 17,892 children and young people in out-of-home care in New South Wales. That was the number when the O'Farrell government was elected at the end of March. That's 11 in 1,000, or over 1 in 100 children and young people. As with so much else, I think the former government assumed if you threw money at a problem, it was fixed. But those numbers tell a different story. There would be no one in New South Wales who does not know how difficult it is to adopt a child here or how long that takes. One of the many process reforms we've embarked upon is ways to streamline and speed up processes and to reduce the bureaucracy surrounding adoption. We believe this will lead to more adoptions and better lives for children and young people, including our adolescents. Well, there are any number of other reforms in family and community services that are vitally necessary, and of course we will pursue them. Opening those cans without financial constraints in some senses makes it easier, but also more difficult. We began with a budget gap bequeathed by Labor in my own area of $1.9 billion over 4 years, meaning reform for FACTS includes making it financially sustainable, getting it back in the black, as well as systematically sustainable. And for those who believe that budget management is a trivial issue and that we should spend whatever it takes to keep our children safe, let me make 2 points. First, state governments particularly don't have unlimited resources. Instead, they have competing priorities. And just like every other part of government, we need to work within our means. Running a system with unrealistic expectations is neither fair nor just. Running a system without unrealistic expectations, when you build on the needy's hopes and you build on a house of cards, is immoral. Too often, good non-government programs have been closed or only pilots funded because finances have not been managed effectively. Social justice demands financial sustainability. Second, sticking within a budget imposes a reform culture, as we are inevitably asked to do more with less. Innovation and creativity are frequent outcomes of scarcity, as I think Darwin would tell us. Labor's legacy in housing was a social housing waiting list of 43,000 people and a public housing maintenance backlog of 300 million. New South Wales' ageing housing stock is misaligned to tenants' needs. We need to have big houses when we have big households where households have shrunk, and the problems of disadvantage are often entrenched problems in housing estates. To address the backlog and those problems will clearly require billions of additional expenditure which we don't have, or innovative solutions which the government needs to find. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I certainly don't underestimate the difficulties of this task, its riskiness and its urgency. The government also appreciates that the death of any child is one too many, and that these reforms must only ever make children's lives better and safer. While I've outlined a number of particular challenges, the list is not exhaustive. But there are, I think, a number of common themes emerging, and on these I will conclude. First, it's important that we test each improvement we make against its contribution to making a child's life better instead of the usual imperatives of political risk management. Secondly, the dangers of believing the system is right just as it is. While this is almost never true, it is particularly never true in the dark and complex world of social dysfunction. We need to build a culture that learns from its mistakes, turns questions on their head, surprises and delights itself with new ideas. By contrast, we cannot afford a culture that resents scrutiny, hides its mistakes, holds its knowledge to itself, and ignore those who dare question its philosophy. Third, we need to stop thinking that money is always the answer. In fact, as I say, money often gets in the way when it's handled poorly, and while it may create more work in bureaucracies, it may not ever reach the ground. Sure, we need enough money, but we also need good ideas, shared commitments, and enthusiastic frontline workers, rather than discouraged ones who may spend as much time photocopying and at a computer than they do seeing children. Finally, we know that government cannot solve every family problem or dysfunction. To improve the lives of vulnerable children and families, the state government is responsible for doing its best in serving the public to work better and smarter to improve services and never stop learning to improve. The federal government is responsible for income support and working with state service provision to align our efforts and programs, not work against each other. And families, like us all, are responsible for their choices. We know there are no silver bullets. We know there is no perfect child protection system. But we need to believe in change and seek to build a culture that thrives on the challenge of continuous change for the better. So long as we remain true to our vision for children, our vision of safe and happy childhoods, then change cannot harm us. If that is a challenge for the thousands of staff at the Department of Family and Community Services, believe me, it will also be a challenge for government. It means leadership of the daily, not the occasional kind. It means stretching your team and urging them on. It means never thinking we'll get away with it just this once. It means never believing that we're there yet. We need to break disadvantage rather than just continue to manage it. And that is the challenge I will hold myself and my colleagues to. The children and young people of New South Wales and the urgency of arresting the intergenerational cycle of despair demand that we give it our best shot. Thank you.
Many thanks, Minister. So firstly, thanks to CAWS, Chambers Westgart, for providing this fine facility this evening. And so we come to questions and discussion, and we'll conclude no later than 7 o'clock. It was very blunt, very interesting, very blunt address, very honest address, but can I just raise the first issue about what she said about the consequences of drug and alcohol abuse within your portfolio? I mean, they extend beyond your portfolio, but it's obviously extremely serious. But what can any government do, federal or state, about this? We hear a lot at the moment about gambling, but we don't hear so much about the kind of problem you're talking about with drug and alcohol abuses leading to the abuse and death at times of young children. Realistically, this doesn't involve money either, but what can you do in that kind of area? Or what are you trying to do?
Another lecture really, but drug and alcohol abuse is obviously a major problem for child protection, but it's a major problem for disadvantage. In Australia, where you have a reasonably low unemployment rate and reasonably good economic growth, people are not unemployed long term by accident. There is inevitably a number of factors that go into that unemployment, and drug and alcohol abuse is one of those. And it's often related to mental illness, but not always. And of course, there are a variety of programs, abstinent programs, that, depending on the intensity of them and the desire of the person to change, can be beneficial. But I think we have to get honest in Australia, particularly about alcohol. In the United States, it's methamphetamines. In this country, it is alcohol. Fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, as I say, is the single largest cause of intellectual disability in children in the Western world, and in this country, that is a particular problem. I think that needs to be said. This is a country where the alcohol culture is so deeply embedded that we don't talk about it. We don't have any labelling about it. We're happy to warn people about the dangers of smoking, but we're very reluctant to say anything about alcohol. And I think that there is a much bigger conversation that the country has to have about the role of alcohol in our culture. And by world standards, I mean, we're said to be the second largest drinkers in the country, in the world, and that obviously impacts on all of us, but it particularly impacts on people who make poor choices anyway. So it is a problem we can address at the margins, But if we are to tackle it systematically, as we have with smoking, then I think it needs a very honest confrontation with Australians about how serious their drinking problem really is. Having said that, smoking rates are higher in the low socioeconomic groups because they are harder to reach and persuade that this is in their long-term interest. So it is a challenge. But it's interesting, in some Californian jurisdictions now with child protection, that's where they put all their early intervention money, drug and alcohol programs. They don't worry about domestic violence or mental health. They accept that the one thing they're most likely to affect is drug and alcohol management.
In looking at the different varieties of reasons for child abuse, you've broken down whether it's a mother thing or a father thing, or whether it's more a mother thing or more a father thing. I mean, you discriminate in the sense that where is a child most at risk?
Well, I'm not the subject expert here. There are others in this room who know much more about that. But look, obviously, in low socioeconomic households, there is a large number of single parent households, and they are overwhelmingly female. But I don't think we can infer from that that it's a women's problem. I think we infer from that it's what happens when you have changing partners very often, so an unstable family life for the child, and the unemployment and lack of access to a work culture that will go along as part and parcel of that. Frank.
You might help me. I just wanted to raise a question about family restoration.
Yes.
Restoring children to the care of natural parents.
Yes.
And I was wanting to raise it in relation to legal aid, because at the moment, a parent who wishes to go back to the children's court to try to have their children restored to them has to file a Section 90 application, which is the part of the Act which relates to restoration or reordering of the... thinking of the order. And legal aid is increasingly refusing to give parents a grant for a Section 90 application. That seems to me to further disadvantage already disadvantaged people, and I wonder whether you have anything to say about that.
Well, look, I'm certainly conscious of that as a problem, but I think the answer really is to let's avoid court wherever possible because of the cost. Let's avoid court wherever possible. So that's why we are much keener on alternate dispute resolution and family conferencing to see if we can head off the need for those very demanding, time-consuming and inevitably expensive processes that, as you suggest, don't always get it right and people aren't always funded to go back to it.
With regard to the problem with drug and alcohol, how do you feel about the continuing methadone clinics and the clinics, the double clinics that try and care for both methadone people and people that are addicted to alcohol? They usually work together.
Well, I mean, I don't know what the evaluation suggests, but obviously you need programs that effectively keep either people off heroin or enable them to manage their addiction so that they aren't so distracted by the need for the next hit that they haven't noticed their child hasn't been fed for a few days. Well, we obviously want to make drug and alcohol education a priority. I mean, this does not mean that we leave children in houses where there are drug addicts shooting up every day. I think, as you see in other jurisdictions, there's a much more increasing... There's a greater use of short-term orders. I think Victorians have a much greater likelihood of removing children for 2 years whilst they give a family some services to help them get their act together. If at the end of those 2 years the family is still unable to care for their children, then the child is removed until they're 18.
Minister, you mentioned that problems within your portfolio and you were speaking with the Minister for Healthy Lifestyles and Aboriginal Affairs. Given that Australia is relatively, in the world sphere, dominant in sporting facilities and events. What role does sport play in preventing mental illness, alcohol and drug-related problems in Australia?
Well, I mean, as again, I'm not the subject expert in that, but clearly if you can give kids, and boys and girls, because I've certainly been to Aboriginal communities where the boys are all encouraged to play sport and the closest the girls get is the debutante's ball every 3 years. So let's make that both boys and girls, give them the opportunity to play sport, and that's good for their health, and it engages them in the sort of cooperative team work that good citizenship is based upon. I've had a relatively recent conversion on the role of sport in teaching good citizenship. Now that I understand you don't have to be good at it to do it, I think it's a very healthy thing. I think Jeremy Sammet had a question, didn't you?
I don't know. Put your hand up, we'll find out. Somewhere down the back. I think I'd better run this, otherwise we lose. Completely lose. Lewis hasn't got over habits from the NBC.
Hello, thank you firstly for that really honest presentation. It was great to hear you particularly talk about caseworkers seeing children and the importance of that and balancing that with the paperwork. Just wondering if you have a view, you spoke about the fact caseworkers seeing the children monthly, wondering if you have a view on how many children caseworkers can manage if they're looking at seeing them that regularly.
Well, as you would know, the ratio in the department is 1 to 29, which is unacceptable. Essentially, children are only seen by our caseworkers if there's a crisis, and that's why we are not an accredited out-of-home care provider, because we can't manage it. When I raised this with the American authorities and said it means that we only see children in a crisis, they were absolutely shocked, because that's what their ratios are too, and they manage to ensure that all their children are seen monthly with a staff ratio like that. So that's actually what drove this idea that we should actually make it clear that the caseworkers' important job is seeing children, and let's work out what administration tasks need to be changed to enable that to occur. So I don't have a view on it, but I do know that other jurisdictions work within a similar ratio. I know that some of our out-of-home care providers in the non-government sector have ratios as low as 1 to 8, which is a half a day a week with each child, which is an extraordinary amount of attention to a child who, in a sense, is no longer in danger because they've been removed and are in foster care. So I think that's part of these negotiations that we currently having about contracting. But I note that some jurisdictions are able to see a lot of children with very high ratios. I think...
we'll get him in a minute. We're getting the microphone down there. That's sort of... just tell us, just while we're getting this... what's all the photocopying that takes place? I mean, you're talking about the bureaucratic... I mean, how much photocopying can you do during the day that would take up all that time?
You can do hours of it.
But for what purpose?
A court.
Yeah.
It's court work, and we have just begun a project with the courts to see... we have to take our case to the courts to make the case that... the amount of photocopying of documents. And remember, we will sometimes have 7 volumes of files on a child. And to photocopy each one of those pieces of paper, and to keep them in the right order and to make multiple copies of it. I know you might think that you can print banknotes, you can do this, but it is clearly an onerous task, because it's one that's raised with me at every staff meeting I go to.
Does that mean that those notes are not on an electronic form?
They should be, but they cannot always be.
No,
and because
you just email.
Yes, you'd think so, but look, I think when caseworkers go out to visit a family, they might not necessarily write it in an electronic form. But we just have to get much better at managing that sort of information.
Okay, we got it.
Pardon? Oh, you could scan it, but it takes time.
Okay, there's a question here.
Yep.
Hello, Prue.
Yeah.
I applaud your commitment to increasing accountability and
some point, if the workload is going to be managed, kids are not going to have... You'll need to have a mechanism for removing kids from the system who otherwise will just float through it. We're going to be re-reported and have an extended history, both with involving the statutory system and with the care system. And I'm wondering how your adoption policy is going to work. Are you thinking of having time limits, that decisions have to be made if the children's circumstances haven't been approved, if they're lingering in care and they can't be returned home if the family circumstances don't sufficiently improve? How's your adoption policy going to fit into this?
It's a very important question, because one of the things you don't want to see is children being adopted who shouldn't be adopted, who actually should be able to return home, and for whom we have made a cavalier decision. So it's a very sensitive decision. Australians are, for some reason, very wary of adoption. It might go back to the 50s and some of the things that happened there with young women, but I think we have to think that through and be clear at the points at which adoption becomes a possibility. Of course, modern adoption, because it's a much more open system and birth parents are involved, what we're obviously hoping to do is to ensure that you have an open adoption which still enables birth parents who wish to stay in touch, and all the research shows that that children like to have some contact with birth family, or at least some knowledge of it, because it's about their sense of identity. Even if they, a young boy I met today who's fought for 14 years to go home, is now 18, has gone home, seen it, and doesn't want to ever go there again. But so even as adults, they might decide that they don't want any further contact. You need to give them that choice and need to enable them to make that decision for themselves. So open adoption clearly makes this a more palatable alternative for our system than the old days of secrecy and children never really knowing and birth parents not knowing what happened to their children. But we have to be quite clear at the point at which we allow it and encourage it. But we have, unfortunately, very difficult processes that, with the best will in the world and the birth parent and the adoptive parent all wanting it and the child, and it still can take years.
So will you make the department apply to legally free children for adoption against the will of parents?
I think we're going to have to work that through, because obviously there will be circumstances in which that is necessary. If that is the child's wish, and the adoptive parents, who have often been the foster parents, can demonstrate a very stable and loving relationship, and it's in the child's best interests, then adoption against the parents' wishes might have to occur. But that's something I think that this new process of reform has to think through very carefully. But it's certainly true, it's possible now.
Minister, if a stable and loving relationship is the most important thing for a child in relation to adoption, why does there seem such resistance to same-sex relationships being able to adopt or being in that sort of relationship?
It's lawful in New South Wales, and as I understand, all but a couple of non-government agencies facilitate same-sex adoptions. I think our foster carers, amongst our foster carers, same-sex couples are a small but very important and terrific part of that system. So I don't think there are legal barriers, but of course it's important to enable agencies such as a Catholic Church, if they don't wish to facilitate same-sex adoption, it's important to have allow them to make that choice as an institution, and that's what the law provides.
Do you buy the idea that the London riots were partly the result of decades of poor family, community and housing policy? And given what you think of Labor's track record, we'll be sitting on time.
Look, it would be so tempting to answer that question off the top of my head, but I've been disciplined and beaten into submission, and I think I can say that that's a very difficult question, and I don't know the answer, and I suspect they don't yet know the answer, because I think there were many factors at work in those riots, one of which was tweeting and twittering and social networking that made a response possible that 10 years ago would not have occurred, despite the fact that you had the same families and the same neighbourhoods and the same entrenched disadvantage. So we need to know a little more.
We'll make this the second last question. Yeah.
Thank you. Minister, I work in Western Sydney with large numbers of totally disadvantaged families, and one of my very strong concerns, in the last 18 months we've been able to return 158 children who've been under long-term suspension to schools without any further suspension or as school refuses. We've also been able to invite families who would otherwise not be associated with service agencies to take the facilities that are available. This morning I started a program with parents, with a group, seven of whom, single parents in the main, seven of whom could be reunited with their children. They have papers to say they can be reunited with their children if they can find housing. And the housing list is so long. They're not going to be able to find housing, so therefore they're not going to be able to be reunited with their children. And a lot of rehabilitation work has been done to put them in the position where they could be reunited with their children. That seems to be
housing is an incredibly important problem because obviously it's a great risk factor for children, and you know, we have a huge waiting list. I think both the previous government, the federal government, and ourselves have all made a very big effort in the last couple of years to building more affordable and social housing, and also extending the range of products so that people can rent in the private market. New South Wales has a housing supply issue. And this is obviously particularly going to impact on low-income families particularly. And part of that answer is we need to create more pathways out of dependency and welfare dependency for parents to enable them to earn the money they need to be part of the private market. But overwhelmingly, it's just a problem. I agree.
Just the final question. You spoke about some of the reporting that's going to happen some later in the year, but if you've only been in office 6 months, but if at the end, say, of the end of next March, what would you hope to be able to say you've actually achieved in the first 12 months? What would you, within your portfolio, what would you regard as the key achievements you'd like to bring about?
I'd like to think that the transfer to the non-government sector is well underway, and that we're moving children into agencies with, as I say, that nimbleness and creativity to care for them. I'd like to think that we are doing better with restoration and policies that enable us to work with families while keeping the children safe to address the reasons why families can't look after their children, but that we never resile from the importance of removing a child that's in an unsafe circumstance. I mean, the easy answer is the answer of 100 years ago. Just take the kids. Just take them, put them in orphanages, put them... I mean, there are no foster parents able to look after the number of disadvantaged children if we took them all. So put them in orphanages and then they'll be safe. The problem with that solution is that they're safe for now. But the history of institutional care for children is, as we know, that it so often produces terrible outcomes for parenthood, for them as parents, and for successive generations. So knowing that, it's a much more complex thing than just saying the safe thing is to remove the children. That's the responsibility of the state. Yep, just take them all, put them in orphanages and keep them there until they're old enough to either go back home or they can fight and fend for themselves. But the long-term answer is not as simple as that. Frustrating for the general public, because I think the general response is take the kids. They're not being looked after properly, so take the kids. The tragedy is that has been the history of welfare for 150 years, and there is no evidence that it has produced a happier generation of children, or more importantly, broken that cycle of disadvantage. In fact, the evidence is to the contrary.
Many thanks. Minister, take a seat, please. Yeah. So it's great that Prue Goward could come along tonight and talk about a very important topic. It's been Minister for
Family and Community Services, of course, with regards also the Minister for Women, but being Minister for Family and Community Services is a pretty tough job in the New South Wales government, and the statistics and the facts in the speech make that very clear. It was a very frank address. I certainly learned a lot, and we'd like you to come back sometime in the future and just talk about how it's all going. Now, obviously, you can't make changes instantly, but it's encouraging that you're looking at the changes that can be made and looking into the future about that. So I must say it was a very compelling speech. I didn't sort of enjoy listening to it, but I found the message incredibly important, and I'm very pleased you gave it here, and I'm sure there are a lot of comments in your speech that will be quoted into the future. But for tonight, thanks and well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.